This is Scotland's Talking. My name's Rob. We're going to talk first this morning about dementia. Now, you know, it's reckoned that 90,000 people are living in Scotland with the condition, but of course, it goes much wider than that. If there's someone in your family who has dementia, well, yeah, everyone's going to be affected by it in some way. So I suppose that figure could be more in the hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions, actually, if you think about the whole of Scotland. If that's you, if you're one of them, I'm hoping you'll join our conversation this morning. The number is 0333 20 2401. Now, of course, dementia manifests itself in so many ways, and one of those is how your world shrinks, because, you know, partly it's all to do with your freedom. Your personal mobility can be curtailed. So I'm going to introduce you this morning to James, as it's Sunday. I use his Sunday name. He's Dr. James McKillock. Now, James has written a small book all about his own experiences with dementia, and very specifically about how he had to give up driving. It's all about that struggle to admit to yourself that you can't do it anymore. And it's about James's family too. Just how do you tell your husband or your wife, your mum or your dad that you just don't think they're safe behind the wheel anymore? You know, have you had to have that chat with someone in your family? It's 0333 20 2401. Please feel free to jump in at any point and join in the chat that we're having with James. And remember, if you want to write down your thoughts, you can email rob at thegreatesthits.co.uk. We're on Twitter at Scotland's Talking. Good morning, James. How are you this morning?
Good morning, listeners. I'm fine today, thank you.
And with James this morning also, we've got Andrina Coburn, who's from the Life Changes Trust. Good morning, Andrina.
Good morning.
What is the Life Changes Trust?
The Life Changes Trust is a charity that was set up by the Big Lottery in 2013 for a period of 10 years. And the main aim really is to improve the lives of people with dementia and unpaid carers in Scotland, as well as care experienced young people. So through the dementia programme, we fund a variety of projects across Scotland with that aim of just improving the lives of people with dementia and carers. And one of the things we fund is peer-to-peer resources, which is the funding behind James's booklet.
OK, yes, let's talk to James a little about this booklet, because I came across this in the library, James, and I picked it up and I thought it was going to be one of these very boring sort of government leaflets you got. And I started reading and I got absolutely gripped by it. It was a really emotional story. It's all about how you first notice your dementia and then the effect that it's had on your life, particularly through driving. So it's take us through the story. What was, you know, how was it that you first noticed that something wasn't quite right?
Well, I didn't notice it myself because I was always a perfect driver, but my wife began to complain that I was weaving about in the road. And instead of following a straight line, I was going like an S shape. And then a couple of times, I came to a dual carriageway and started to go down the wrong way.
Oh, no.
That was horrific because I could have killed, ended my car and worse, somebody in another car. Could have killed a family. So, but again, I didn't understand what was wrong because I hadn't had a diagnosis. So, and then getting lost. Sometimes I'd be going in a familiar territory and I'd have to stop and think, where am I going? And it was very confusing. You didn't think there was anything wrong. You just couldn't understand what the problems were.
Yeah. I think you write in the booklet that roundabouts could be particularly baffling sometimes.
Yes. Because by the time I came to a big roundabout, I'd read the direction signs before it. But the second I was on the roundabout, I couldn't remember where my turn-off was. So what I had to do was take the first left. If it wasn't that turn, come back to the roundabout, take the next left until I got to the one I wanted, which was very time-consuming.
So you were just left going round and round these roundabouts?
Mm-hmm.
You must have got dizzy as much as anything else.
Well, more my passengers than me.
Did you always have somebody with you in the car when these things happened? Did it ever happen to you when you were out on your own?
Well, most of the times I had a member of the family with me, say my young son, but it did happen a couple of times when I was alone and, you know, you just stop and think, no, what's going on here? Because without a diagnosis, you know something's not quite right, but you don't know what.
I suppose the thing is, you maybe think it could be all sorts of things or just not concentrating or being absent-minded, because I think all of us who drive have this experience that we'll be a million miles away thinking about something else and we miss our turning or we'll, you know, pull out somewhere where we shouldn't, and you just slap yourself to the wrist and say, oh, silly me. You don't think there's anything medical or it's necessarily a condition, do you?
No, I was possibly other things in my mind that I put it down to that. But unfortunately, it wasn't that, but it took a wee while to get a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how did matters come to a head? And I think, really, you sort of faced a revolution within the family, didn't you?
Yes. We had a car for 20 years, and when we got a car and these problems, my wife started to see them. She stopped me taking my son out with him, and she wouldn't sit in the car with me. If we were in the car together, she insisted on driving because she was very worried about my capabilities. Before, she said she never felt so safe when I was driving, but things had changed for the worse.
And at this stage, did you know it was dementia? Did you have a name for whatever it was?
No. I'd met dementia many a time when I worked in England, but I didn't recognise when it was happening to myself. And again, my wife didn't know because the public aren't trained to look out for signs of dementia.
So how did you actually get that diagnosis? How did that process work?
Well, because of a lot of problems that I won't get into, eventually the doctor sent me for a scan, and when I got the report, they talked about the damage to my brain, and showed up, it was what's called TIAs, transient ischemic attacks, and that showed the brain damage.
And there's quite a process that goes through, isn't there? Because the DVLA get notified, I think, that there's concerns about you, and there's assessments and things as well. What happened in your case?
Well, once I got a diagnosis, I knew enough to know you had to report not just dementia, but other serious illnesses to DVLA. And they sent me for a test, which I passed. What was good was the test was conducted in a familiar area, so I knew where I was going. I knew when I was passing a school around about 3 o'clock to slow down under 30 because a child could dash into the road. So I passed the test and I was given a licence for 3 years. At the end of 3 years, I fully expected to get another test, but on Christmas Eve, I got a letter from the DVLA saying they'd withdrawn my licence. 21 days to appeal, and my wife was really scared of me driving again, so that didn't come off.
Christmas Eve.
I've been
waiting. What was that
like?
That must have been, firstly, a shock and the blow to your pride.
It was, because I'd been all those years without a car. Now I'd had freedom to go where I wanted, when I wanted, and that had been wrenched from me. And I just felt terrible about it. I still do after 14 years. I still really think that I could have driven another couple of years safely before it came to the point where I was no longer safe.
Your family don't agree with that, though, do they?
Oh, no, my wife is over the moon because I couldn't drive again.
Does it cause a lot of tension? You know, are you frustrated and your wife and your son worried? Is it just... You have this tension in the family the whole time?
At that time, yes. Nowadays, there's still a bit, because I keep saying to my wife, no, you should have gone there, you should have stopped there. I'm a bad front seat driver.
And there's a really emotional bit in the book. You talked about the times that you were tempted to get back behind the wheel. And there was one time where you'd been left alone for 3 weeks mm-hmm. at a time. Tell me about that.
Well, obviously, my wife was away, so I'd never sat behind a wheel for an awful long time because it was too hurtful. And I had to sit behind to start the engine, to keep the battery charged. And I really wanted to just reverse and drive away. And it was a fight. And luckily the good side won, that I could have knocked an innocent child down because I live near a school. So with a lot of regret, I shut the engine off, closed the door and put the keys away out of sight.
Must have been one of the hardest things you've ever done, though.
Yes. But for years I've been campaigning for people with dementia who have lost their licence to drive again. I don't mean in a public highway, but maybe an area where they could drive safely without danger to anybody else or themselves.
And you've done that, haven't you? Tell us about that.
Yes, well, I've been talking about it for a long time, And there's a place called Dementia Adventure in Essex. They were holding training courses up in near Elgin, and they arranged with a local driving school to take me to an airfield, an empty one, by the way, and just to drive again with the feelings. So I thought it would be difficult, but I sat behind the wheel. I took off. The person told me when to change into second gear, and after that, I drove as if I'd never been away. I asked them to do things as if it was a driving test, you know, do U-turns, left-hand turns, right-hand turns, reversing. I was perfect, and I got up to 60 miles an hour. Didn't want to go faster than that. And the only thing I missed there was a hill start. On an aerodrome, there weren't many hills.
So do you think you're a good driver? Do you think you could still drive?
I could still handle a car, no doubt about that. But I couldn't handle a traffic situation. But even as a passenger at roundabouts, I get quite agitated. No, so I know I couldn't drive on the public highway. I could physically drive a car up, but I wouldn't be safe. I know that.
Well, you said you asked to be treated like it was a driving test. So let's find out if you pass the driving test, because I've got on the line now the chap that you were with who took you out on the airfield that morning. His name was Kieran O'Driscoll. Good morning, Kieran.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us on Scotland's Talking, and you can chat again with James, who's here with me in the studio. What do you remember about that day? Because I think this was the first time you'd done something like this, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the first time, once and only. I remember it very well. He surprised me. He just sat in the car and drove like he'd never stopped driving.
What?
Never had to give him any information. Nothing.
What were you expecting? You expecting somebody who was going to stall it and bunny hop down the runway?
Yeah, I didn't really know what to expect, but I've got dual control and I can take control of any situation, but I didn't have any control at all.
I mean,
he drove and he drove.
I mean,
I never spoke an hour and a half or whatever we were there. I don't know. I just told him where to go and that was it.
So you were just being taken for a drive. From what you could see from the passenger seat, could you see, you know, what this meant to James, you know, as he was driving along?
His expression at the end was priceless. It was a good feeling for me to see that how he appreciated it and what it meant to him. It was a wonderful experience.
Because I suppose you'll be used to having your clients who are learning to drive for the first time who are passing the test, and you'll see the moment of joy when they get their license, yeah. They rip up the old plate and the freedom that it gives them. What you're seeing here is it's just the other end of the story, and somebody who's lost that freedom, lost that sense of, you know, a wide open world and everything's getting closed in, and just to get that back for just a couple of hours must have been wonderful.
Yeah, it was amazing. You get a wonderful feeling when you see them passing the test and you see all the joy they've got, but the joy in his face was just unbelievable. Done a lot for me, let alone him.
James, what do you remember of that day?
Well, first of all, I was amazed at your courage in going out with somebody with dementia, because people have an idea you can't do anything. So I'm really grateful that you took courage to do that. So again, I was over the moon, not just that day, but for weeks afterwards. You know, the buzz it gave me, the thrill it gave me, has lasted a long time.
Well, Kieran, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We will we'll continue talking to James in just a moment, and we'll maybe examine, you know, what we can do as a family and how we should perhaps make life easier for any relative. Maybe it's our mum or our dad who's going through something similar, and perhaps some tips on how we can ease that process. And also coming up in the next half hour of the programme, we're going to hear from a policeman who's been telling Scotland's Talking that he's shocked by the extent of underage drinking and just how underage some of those kids are.
What we've uncovered, which is really quite sad, I suppose, is out of the people we've taken home, the children we've taken home this year, four on separate occasions have been 12 years of age. And I think in anybody's eyes, that is totally unacceptable. That firstly, kids of that age are asking for alcohol, but actually the adults have and are prepared to buy for kids who are 12.
So if you've got any thoughts on dementia, want to join the conversation with James, or you'd like to talk about kids as young as 11 and 12 buying alcohol or having alcohol bought for them. Our number 0333 2020 401.
You could be next on Scotland's Talk-In. Call 0333 2020 401.
This is Clyde 2.
It's 10:26. This is Scotland's Talk-In, and my name's Rob. I'm sitting in for Ali this week. I've got a couple of guests with me in the studio who are talking about issues around dementia, particularly dementia and driving. If that's something that's been a feature in your family, maybe you've got a father or a mother, or maybe even you yourself have had to give up driving because you've had a diagnosis of dementia, or you're concerned that you may have to. Please feel free to jump in and join us. The number's 0333 2020 401. If you want to text show to 61054. On email, it's rob@thegreatesthits.co.uk. You can also tweet at Scotland's Talking. So it's Dr. James MacKillop who's with me, who has written a book all about his experience with dementia and driving, and Andrina Coburn, who's from the Life Changes Trust. Now, James was telling us about how he first noticed that he was starting to not be the driver that he used to be. He'd go round and round roundabouts because he'd forgotten which exit that he wanted, and how his wife and his son were frightened to be with him in the car, and they made him always go in the passenger seat. It was hard on you, James. How best can we deal with this as families? You know, what would you like to have seen? You know, with the benefit of your experience, could people have been a bit more gentle in the way that they suggested to you that you're not a very good driver anymore?
Yeah, it's a hard truth. If somebody's not fit to drive, they shouldn't be in the road.
As simple as that. Mm-hmm. But you didn't like the way that this kind of guillotine came down on you, and this letter on Christmas Eve that mm-hmm. said, that's it, no more driving. You're not in favour of that, are you?
No, I felt I should be given the chance to drive, because dementia does not automatically mean you give up driving. You should be able to sit a test, and if I had been given another test and failed it, I would have been quite happy. But I felt I could have driven for a few years longer. It's very hard to do it gently. But I think you've got to point out the dangers, so not just to yourself, your family, but to others in the road.
So you've made this suggestion in the pamphlet you've written, this idea of a graduated licence, that maybe there should be restrictions, that you don't drive at night, or you don't go so far away from home. How do you see that working?
If you've got a licence, it means you're fit to drive anywhere in the United Kingdom, any time of the day or night, no matter the road conditions or weather conditions. But I've been round bits of Scotland, the borders and the Highlands, and some people might have no bus service at all, or the bus might come once in the morning, once in the afternoon. So I feel that if people are able to drive quite well, they should be given a restricted licence within a certain area, within certain times of the day, so that they can get out. Otherwise, they're stranded. And for people with dementia, the main thing is to get out into company.
What do you find at the Life Changes Trust, Andrina? Is this something that people come to you quite regularly with?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons we decided to fund work around travelling well with dementia was because it is an issue that's raised again and again with us by people with dementia. And I think, as James has touched on there, particularly in rural and island communities, driving can be the way that you maintain your social connections and you continue to participate in activities. And if that's taken away from you, then you really need to make sure that the existing options for transport that are available to people are accessible, and that staff are well trained in understanding the needs of people travelling with dementia. So a lot of the work that we fund is really about helping transport and related services to ensure that they can develop their services from a real life experience point of view. One of the projects that we're currently funding is working with the ESP Group for a 16-month project where they saw an opportunity to improve the process of support for people with dementia undergoing the difficult transition of giving up driving. So they're going to look at the driving assessment process before and after, and the whole way through that journey, to see how they can better support people. And they're going to co-design that service with people with dementia. And everything that we fund is really about having the voice of people with dementia at the heart of it. That's why we have people like James who advise us to make sure we're funding along the right lines and we're doing the right things.
We talk about just stop, you know, having to stop driving just like that. And maybe it's fine that you'll have a wife or family who can still help you to get out in a car. But if instead you're having to rely on public transport, James has talked about how baffling it was to arrive at a junction or an unfamiliar roundabout. If you imagine getting a train into the big city, I mean, what on earth makes us think that that's any less disconcerting to somebody with dementia than a situation they find out on the road?
Yeah, and dementia is not just about memory, it's about all your other senses as well. So travelling can be a really noisy and busy and daunting experience for people. And a lot of the barriers that have been highlighted to us are people don't feel safe travelling anymore, they feel anxious. And a lot of that is down to complex travel processes like timetables and ticketing. A lot of it is down to service provider staff not having that awareness of dementia, and also just about that loss of confidence that comes with maybe having a diagnosis of dementia. And you don't feel that you can do the things that you want to do. And really all of the work that we're doing is about trying to help people understand better how they can support people with dementia when they're travelling.
If you had one bit of advice, James, what would it be?
Get to know how to use public transport. I was in a group once, and I was the only one that used the buses. The rest all either drove or were driven. And so I got them to first bus to see how to pay the exact fare and how to sit down quickly. Don't stop in the middle of the passageway and chat to somebody, because buses can throw you. So pay your fare, get down quickly. Of course, nowadays, a lot of people have a bus pass, so which makes it a lot easier. I've been told by bus drivers, no, you're putting in too much money, because I couldn't count money. And quite often I say to the bus driver, I don't know where I'm going. I got on the bus, I know beforehand where I'm going. I repeat it as I'm going along the road. I got on the bus, I can't remember where I'm going. They usually just give me a ticket and I sit down and get off when I come to my journey, but it can be confusing. Are you going home or are you going out somewhere?
And it's important as well that people can get out and about and be involved in community life, because that's a really important part of living well with dementia.
And if this is ringing a bell with people, if they're hearing this and thinking, yeah, you know, that's maybe I've got concerns about somebody in my family, where can we go to and where's the best place to turn for help? Obviously, I found James's pamphlet in my local library, and you know, I thought, this sounds really interesting. I think we're going to have to have him on the programme and listen to the story. But what can people do?
Well, you can get the booklet. You can download it from our website, which is www.lifechangestrust.org.uk, or you can contact us and we can send you a copy. But James has been out and about a lot, dropping off leaflets in libraries and doctor surgeries and other places. When he's on holiday, he takes a lot of them with him and distributes them, so you may just be able to find it in your local library as well.